Hello and welcome to the Small Flicks Podcast. My name is Allie.
And I am Boomer.
And I'm Brandon.
Yeah, and we are three friends who talk over the internet about movies. This weekend, of course, as any movie person knows, it was the Oscars. For the first time in, like, forever, I finally got to watch the Oscars. I went to a local Irish pub. We had a competition on seeing who could get the most right on their ballot. I only got 13 out of 23, but the proprietor seemed impressed. So we'll see. For some reason, they still haven't tallied it, but it was a lot of fun. They had like a drink special. It was wild. It was like, sorry for you Sobey people out there. It's going to kind of sound gross if you're not into these things, but it was champagne, raspberry liqueur, and then it was like topped off with Guinness. So it was like really, I liked it. But yeah, if you're not into like Guinness, you probably wouldn't have.
See, I always have champagne and pizza for the Oscars.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
We do sports yelling at the movies once a year. It's fun.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of like clapping and shouting. The proprietor of said pub was really into Oppenheimer, so that was weird because, you know.
Good night for him. I mean.
Yeah, it was a good night for him.
I don't know, winning horse, you know?
Yeah, well, I texted you. I think he was really invested in, you know, Cillian Murphy being Irish, which is such a weird Irish dude.
But he had a cheer for such a posh British boy to win Best Director to get that.
I know,
sense
he
of
really
victory,
did.
You know?
He really did. Just funny. But yeah, big appreciate some of the things. Like you liked the nude John Cena bit.
Yeah, who didn't? That was
hilarious. It was pretty good. It was good. I liked Arnold and Danny DeVito being on stage together. That was fun.
John Mulaney explaining the plot of
my gosh.
Field of Dreams for
yes.
minutes on end for no
that
reason
was
whatsoever.
Incredible.
It was a surprisingly entertaining show.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the Godzilla minus one, people going up on stage with their little Godzilla figurines. Loved it.
Well, that was what was so fun about it was, I mean, they made it a zippier, shorter show than usual, but
yeah.
Also there were a bunch of categories that I was very cynically expecting like very dumb choices to win. And instead it was like Miyazaki and Godzilla and Poor Things won more than I expected to. Like, it was a surprisingly
big night for Poor Things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, as long as you accepted that Oppenheimer was going to win all the big stuff, like, everything below it was actually really fun and surprising.
Yeah.
Justine Triet got a good speech in for Anatomy of a Fall, you know? It was a fun broadcast.
One of the reasons why I did get higher on my scorecard was I voted for the wrong Barbie song on our ballot because I was guessing it was going to be I'm Just Kidding, especially after that wild and amazing performance that they did. But no, it was the other one, the other Barbie song,
a boring one.
Yeah, the boring one. Yeah, I mean, I did love, you know, Billie Eilish being awkward on stage because she's one of those awkward Gen Zers that I'm just like, you're just one of those weird kids, you know.
I mean, best case scenario for the Oscars every year is like movies that don't get talked about enough get a chance to be highlighted on TV in front of like a wide audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this year did a pretty good job of like spreading the wealth there. Like
yeah.
A bunch of movies I liked got a lot of airtime. Yeah, including that big Busby Berkeley Barbie sequence with Ryan Gosling was very fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good night.
It was a good night. Yeah. So I did that. I actually also have been catching up on some movies, and by catching up, I mean I've actually been watching movies. I've actually been catching up on watching movies.
But have you been watching movies and catching up?
Nothing like feeling like you're behind on your hobby and you got to do your homework.
Yeah. It was good to like take a moment and have some movies. So I went to theaters and I saw the somewhat silent black and white comedy Hundreds of Beavers.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
Oh.
Yeah, it was fun. So for those of you who don't know about this movie, since it is like kind of obscure at this point, I would say, it is like I said, semi-silent. There's like sound effects and stuff in it. It is about this guy named John Kayak, who is a Applejack salesman in the fur trading frontier. His business gets destroyed on account of beavers, and then he has to figure out how to survive off the land, and eventually he gets revenge on the beavers themselves, and while he tries to win the heart of a fur outpost person's daughter. So it's fun. My biggest complaint about it is too long. I think it's a lot of fun in that it's just kind of a giant, like, Looney Tunes episode.
Yeah, aren't the beavers basically, like, sports mascot style?
Yeah, I was going to say, all of the animals are all just people in costumes, which is hilarious. There's a lot of great, like I said, like, Looney Tunes style gags.
It also looked like a kind of Guy Madden style, like, yes, throwback to older,
yes,
modes of comic filmmaking.
Yes, very much. But I think the thing about that style of filmmaking is, you know, maybe an hour and a half, like, that's the perfect amount. Like, but after, you know, an hour and a half, you just kind of get fatigued of, like, the nonstop, like, visual gag of jokes. And then once it stretches on to, like, 2 hours, it's just, I don't know, it felt like too much.
Is it 2 hours long?
Yes.
Wow, okay. I did not know that.
That was a thing where I was like, I'm enjoying this and it's very funny and very goofy, but it is so long. So yeah, I still recommend it. I still think you'll have fun with it.
I'm jealous you got to see it. It's basically only playing at Zeitgeist in Araby, which is not accessible by bus for me. So
yeah, I was gonna say,
you know, waiting for it to pop up VOD or something.
Yeah, I had to go to Vancouver, Washington to see it.
Okay. Everyone has to travel.
Yeah, everyone has to travel. I had to go to Vancouver, which was kind of fun because I got to go to their, like, single screen theater downtown that I had never been to before.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, like, I've been to Vancouver to see movies before, surprisingly. But yeah, I've never been to their little, like, historic one. So that was nice and cute.
Coming soon to the theater furthest from you.
Yes, exactly. Coming soon to the theater furthest from you that you've never heard of, that you just got to take a chance on and make a day of it and go to that weird little small town with that single screen movie theater. And give it a chance. Take 2 hours of your life to watch weird live action Looney Tunes with people in animal costumes.
Bring a picnic basket and some folding money for antiques. Make a day of it.
Oh my gosh, yes! Oh, I wish I had. So, yeah, I did that, and I also watched the movie Eye of the Cat. So, Criterion has, right now, a collection of movies that are just cat movies.
Okay.
So, you know, I have to, right? That's just a given. In this movie, there's a rich lady with, like, emphysema who, like, has a bunch of cats. And in typical rich lady with emphysema style, she's going to leave all the money to her cats unless her, like, estranged nephew comes back. And I'm going to put nephew in quotes because I don't think they're actually related. And there's, like, a very weird, like, sexual tension that goes on in between them. And he has a fear of cats. And also she goes to the salon frequently, and her stylist from the salon has heard all about this nephew and all about her cats and how she's going to leave money to her cats after she dies, and hatches a plan to murder this woman and, well, first get with her nephew, murder this lady, and then, you know, get part of the money. So yeah, it was kind of like, you know, I had read, like, oh, it's kind of like The Birds, but with cats, but it's not. It's just kind of, you know, your regular sort of psychological thriller, but there just happens to be some cats involved. There wasn't nearly enough, like, cat-related death for me. And I say this as a cat lover, but there wasn't nearly enough cat-related death. Like, I'm just saying, like, if you go in expecting cats to, like, swarm and kill someone, you're going to be disappointed. But there are a lot of very cute cats. So yeah, I would say, you know, it's kind of average, but it, yeah, I mean, if you just feel like having a movie on in the background that's got, like, 20 cats in it occasionally, then go for it.
Lazy Sunday afternoon viewing.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, it's like, you know how there's just those movies from the 60s that you're just like, yeah, that was kind of average. I expected more from that. But, like, sometimes there's just those good, like, one-liner, like, zingers. There were a couple of those that I really appreciated. One was, there's, like, you know, the swinging 60s vibe that goes on throughout the movie as well. I should say that, which is kind of cool. We gotta love a good, like, oh, here's a hippie party happening in a 60s movie. So during one of these, oh, there's a hippie party happening moments, you, like, there's this passing conversation that you overhear where somebody says, I feel like French cinema has gone from merry and bad to worse. And I'm like, what a good pun. What a good film nerd pun.
That one goes out to all the Delphine Seyrig heads in the audience, you know?
Yes, exactly. The real freaks. Yeah, so I watched those two, and then the other day I was hanging out with a friend who's really into older Italian movies, and we watched Mamma Roma by Pasolini.
I was hoping you were going to have a third one with an animal in the title.
I know! I really missed out on that. I should have recommended one with an animal. But yeah, we watched Mamma Roma, and yeah, it was one of those, like, really, really beautiful movies that's also kind of really sad. So, Anna Magnani, I don't know how to say her name, plays the titular Mama Roma, and she's, like, this lady who's sacrificed a whole bunch in her life for her son, Ettore. And, yeah, like, including, like, being a prostitute for a very long time, and she's missed out on a lot of his life because she's let him, like, live with her family in the country while she's trying to get enough money to have a proper home for them. Yeah, so finally she gets to move in with him, and it's kind of like her, it follows her trying to be a mom, still trying to do her best to, like, take care of her son, and also, you know, following her son kind of growing up and having, you know, the issues that come from, like, your mom not always being there, and, like, having finally, like, taken you in your life, and obviously, like, Rome in the early 60s, you know, because there's a lot of, like, reference to, you know, the fascists, and Rome basically kind of seeming pretty broke. I don't know nearly enough about Rome in the 60s, but you know, anything after, anything only a few years after fascism is going to be having a rough time. But yeah, it's beautiful, awesome. But yeah, a real tearjerker. And it just kind of made me be like, why are old Italian movies sad? And then I'm just like, oh yes, fascism.
I recently saw Teorema for the first time from him. And
I haven't seen that one.
Kind of wickedly funny, but mm-hmm. it has a lot of, like, deep despair in it as well.
Yeah, yeah. Like, this one definitely has, like, humor and, like, you, like, it's hard not to love, like, the main character, even with how deeply flawed she is, like, because she's kind of amazing and just really funny and loud, you know, very Italian. So, yeah, I haven't seen much by him at all.
Me neither. And Theorem, like, instantly I'm watching it, I was like, oh, this is one of the greatest movies ever made. Yeah. Like, no question. Like, yeah. It really just, like, blew me away. And I had only seen Solo before that,
which I have not seen. So
it's something. You should definitely see it at some point.
Yeah, that is kind of what I've heard, is it's something.
But I was clicking around in his filmography, and, like, it's way less intimidating than you would think. Like, there's not that many movies.
Yeah.
So I'm also ready to go on that journey as well.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe we'll do that. We'll do that soon. We'll go on that journey. Like, you know, my Italian cinema, I've been mainly really exposed to Fellini Like, I've watched a ton of Fellini, but yeah, I outside of that, I have just, you know, Tree of Wooden Clogs, you know?
And Argento, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yes,
what about every cheap horror movie?
Yeah, I was going to say, every cheap horror movie, Tree of Wooden Clogs, you know?
I feel like that's where I've run out of titles, is like the cheapo schlock. I feel like I've seen like most of the big stuff by now.
Yeah. Have you watched much Fellini, I guess?
Satyricon, what's the big one? 8.5?
Yeah, 8.5 is the big one.
I mean, kind of like the touchstones. I haven't seen like the deeper cuts.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, my favorite is Juliet of the Spirits. I don't know if you've seen that one, but it's amazing.
Oh, I've heard that's very good.
It's so good. Yeah, so, you know, we'll go down the Italian rabbit hole. We'll go to Italy.
Just no more neo-realist stuff about how hard it is to be a day laborer, please.
I will try my hardest.
I make no promises.
Yes. like really, I was talking about how I've never seen The Bicycle Thief, and how like that's the one like everybody like always talks about when it comes to neorealism. My friend was like, "You should. It's really good." And I was like, "But I heard it is sad." She's like, "It is." So yeah. We'll get there. We'll get there. What have y'all been watching? What have y'all been up to? It's been a couple of weeks.
Well, as for me, I recently did another rewatch of Raising Arizona.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, a couple of summers ago, or I guess a year and a half ago now, in 2022, it was supposed to be the summer of the Coen brothers. And I did pretty good, actually. Managed to get almost all of them done before the end of the year. But unfortunately, one of my friends was like, "Oh, we can watch Raising Arizona." And I was like, "I've already seen that one. It's the second one in their canon." So obviously I watched it really early on in that. So he's been very patient and waited a long time for me to be like, "Okay, it's been long enough that I'm ready to see it again." Because bear in mind, when I was in high school, this was like my favorite movie. So I have seen it like dozens and dozens of times. So like as an adult, I really need to be more sparing with how often I watch it. It still holds up. I'm going to say it every time that I rewatch it. It's great. I love this movie.
Nick Cage looking cute.
Yeah, I was going to say Nick Cage at his cutest, I think, really. I mean,
Valley Girl slander on the pod.
I'm sorry.
We all have a different favorite.
I was about to say, like, maybe Wild at Heart, because, you know, he's just so ridiculous in that movie, but...
That movie's sexy. Valley Girl's cute.
Moonstruck's very horny.
Oh, yeah. Moonstruck as well. You're right.
Yeah.
He's great.
We did a whole
one.
Heartthrob Nick Cage episode on this podcast once, because it was just strange to me that like there was this period where he was like a handsome hunk, you know, like kind of a low-key sex symbol, and that is not how he is cast now. Like, it's kind of ridiculous to think back to that time now.
Yeah, but then you watch those movies and you're like, all right,
the energy's there, you know.
There's something weird about those transitional films where like I feel like he was still capable of playing sexy, but mm-hmm. they were writing him like younger heroes. Specifically, I'm thinking of like Gone in 60 Seconds.
Ah, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. Jeez. That was, you know. Yeah, they did not know how to utilize the cage, I think.
They knew how to use him in Raising Arizona. That movie is still so funny to me. It's still funnier every time I see it. I don't think I could ever get tired of it unless, you know, I watched it every day.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I find really funny about it is that it's this like 80s mid-century modern like design in this trailer. And mm-hmm. I was thinking about this. I didn't bring it up at the time because I didn't have a place for it. But when I watched Prince of Pennsylvania several months ago, it also had like a trailer that was a very like mid-century modern style, like mobile home on the inside. And how like there was a time when that was considered like, you know, so passe and uncool and like, oh, this like signifier of like poverty. Whereas yeah. now people will kill for those. I would love to live in one.
Yeah, I mean, I have a bunch of older friends who like do not understand all of that. They're like, I just associate this with that era. So I don't know. It's so funny. Yeah. It became come kitsch, you're right.
That's me. I love the kitsch. While we are on the subject of the Coen brothers, I'll bring up a Coen brother, which is Ethan. Because I went and saw Drive Away Dolls.
Ooh.
It was fine.
Yeah.
I hate to say, You know, as there are some parts of it that I was very reminded of Lady Killers, open parentheses, derogatory, close parentheses.
Yes.
It was like a lot of their movies, sort of a pastiche of like various things that they just keep doing over and over again. And this one in particular, it really felt like it was trying to be very daring and like, you know, very outre and outrageous, but you can also really tell that it began its life as a project in 2007 with that intent, because it has not like kept up with the radicalism of now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's set in 1999, and the characters in this movie all have those like signs out front now. You know, the ones I'm talking about, the neoliberalism signs.
Mm-hmm.
And this house, etc. Not that there's anything wrong per se with having that, but there is sort of
I like those better than the in our America.
Yes, fair enough.
I was already rolling my eyes at that in Boyhood, like, what, a decade ago?
Yeah.
With, like, Ethan Hawke. There's, like, a scene very pointed where he was, like, setting up Obama hope signs as, like, yes, a signal to what his character was up to on the timeline.
Yeah.
I just, that kind of, like, political posturing from, like, people who've been millionaires for a long time in Hollywood, I just found very eye-rolly, and that was like well over a decade ago already.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that, because I was like expecting to, I was expecting when we spoke tonight, you would let me know what you thought of the review and whether it was too harsh, what, even having not seen it, but like,
I mean, that's the reason I haven't seen it, is it looked a little safe. And what I have been interested in though, is I have heard that it is really raunchy.
It is raunchy. That's true.
Calls my name.
It's raunchy and it's horny, but in like a Tom Robbins kind of way, where I'm not really sure. Where I'm like, ooh, I bet this is erotic to people who are aroused by this, but also like, I bet this is arousing also to like people for whom it's a little more voyeuristic as well.
Yeah,
straight men and young lesbians can both enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a really funny sort of like demographic. I'm just gonna say that straight men and young lesbians, just throwing that out there, that is the funniest sounding demographic I've ever heard.
Well, you probably have to hit both of those metrics to sell the movie to a studio, right? You can't just be like, we're gonna attract just lesbians to come see this, and then you have people looking at the chart of how many people identify that way.
Older angry lesbians.
Oh, they had that. It was called Space Cowboys. With the old astronauts, that's for old straight men and old lesbians.
I feel like if you marketed this to like Gen X lesbians, there would be a lot of like immediate pushback, like, why is a man directing this movie about gay women,
even though, you know, he has his lesbian wife.
Yeah,
which that
the more you dig into
me.
It more great, yeah. That moralism becomes,
because it did feel very much like it was written by a straight man to me when I texted you about it, Brandon, and you were like, oh, doesn't he have a lesbian wife? And that was news to me, and then I read about it and I was like, okay. And that sort of made me realize, I'm like, okay, it's not about sexual identity, it's about generation, I guess, actually, is what's happening here.
I had two moments this week where I realized I listened to way too many movie podcasts. That was one of them, where it's like, I know way too much about, would it say Ethan Coen's
wife,
his like personal life, for somebody who honestly doesn't really care that much about the Coen
brothers.
You're
very Coen agnostic.
Haven't seen this movie.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah,
you are.
I'm neutral. And then also, I got like 19 of the Oscar categories right, and that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you
that's
definitely would have won
much
that.
Insider information.
You definitely would have won that gift certificate just straight up. He just would have handed you like $50, be like, come back to TC O'Leary's Irish Pub. And I'd be like, you're taking me, Brandon. We're going to go to the pub and hang out and act like we're the sorts of people who hang out at the pub all the time.
If I stay at home, I get to, I win all the pizza and champagne I can consume anyway. So I'm already
exactly.
taken care of.
If you are interested in reading more about my thoughts on Drive Away Dolls, that review is now live on swampflix.com. Also, within the past week, I saw Dick from 1999.
Great film.
Do we love this movie around here? I imagine we do.
When I was 13, I thought it was very funny. I can't say I've seen it since.
I don't know if I've seen it. Maybe as you talk about it, I might have.
All right. So for our listeners at home, Dick is a 1999 film about two teenage girls, one of whom lives in the Watergate Hotel in the 1970s. She's played by Michelle Williams, and her best friend is Kirsten Dunst. And they accidentally foil part of the Watergate cover-up. They are the ones who put tape, in the very beginning of the movie, they're the ones who put tape over the lock on this door, which ended up being like very important evidence as to what had happened there. And so very shortly thereafter, they're on a school trip to the White House. They are recognized by several White House aides and are then conscripted to become dog walkers for Nixon's dog Checkers. And over the process of the movie, become Deep Throat accidentally and airheadily.
Are there any double entendres about the sexual nature of the phrase Deep Throat?
Very few, but many, many instances of people about to talk about how they feel about Dick, whether they love Dick or they hate Dick or Dick controls their life. Accidentally being overheard by many people because they've raised their voice to overcome a loud noise which suddenly stops. That happens multiple times.
Dick played by
Dan Hedaya.
Cher Horowitz's dad, Dan Hedaya. <Yeah.
laughs> And I feel like this movie is of a kind with Clueless in the sense that it's also about like superficially airheaded blonde teenagers, you know, doing more with less.
Yeah, they're like Barb and starring their way through their high school years.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of like this is sort of like Romy and Michelle.
Barb and Star go to Watergate.
Forrest Gump, yeah, Forrest Gump at Watergate. It's very funny. It's really funny. I Brandon, I know you were saying that you enjoyed it as a teenager. I'll say that it does hold up. Anna Gasteyer as the secretary to Nixon is probably one of the best performances of her career. Unfortunately, too brief, but like even among all of the things that she's done, I found this one really funny. There is actual tape from the Watergate like scandal that's involved in the movie. Very funny things like one of the girls falls in love with Nixon and leaves him like an 18 and a half minute confession of love on one of the tapes, which is what's accounted for the 18 and a half minute gap, you know, that was part of the actual scandal. It's very funny. I would recommend it very highly. It holds up. It holds up a lot. Last week, for our sort of local unofficial film club, we decided to watch 1976's The Ritz. All right, so this one was a farce that was based on a play. It was directed by Richard Lester, who did like A Hard Day's Night, various other things. Essentially, this movie is about a guy who is hiding out from his mafioso brother-in-law. He asks a cab to take him where no one will look for him and is taken to a gay bathhouse. So it's like this very ritzy lobby area. You get, you know, buzzed in by the doorman and you have to sign in and all of this. And inside he meets like a real fun cast of characters. Jack Weston plays the gentleman in question, but Rita Moreno is the lounge singer who performs in like the downstairs part of the bathhouse. Like, this is a fancy bathhouse. They've got a gym, they've got a pool, they of course have a steam room and a sauna, but they also have like live music as performed by Rita Moreno. The first person that our sort of lead meets is a very fit F. Murray Abraham, like a very fit, wearing nothing but a towel F. Murray Abraham, who's a very camp gay named Chris. He runs afoul of like a very obsessed chubby chaser, who will like stop at nothing to get his hands on, Gaetano, who's our lead. And Treat Williams, is very young, and he's this, he's a detective who was sent to follow Gaetano by his brother-in-law, tracked him to this bathhouse. But like part of the farce element is that Gaetano's brother-in-law, who's played by Jerry Stiller, his name is Carmine Vespucci. So Gaetano puts down that name when he goes to the bathhouse. So, of course, there's this like comedy of errors where they're both supposed to be Carmine Vespucci. And, of course, Brick, this detective who's never seen either of them, is you know, he's supposed to meet Vespucci, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very funny. It has the possibility of having elements that would have aged poorly, but it actually never quite crosses the line. You know, there is some comedy that comes from Gaetano being attracted to Googie Gomez, who's Rita Moreno's character, and then is told by one of the others that she's a drag performer. And then, you know, from that point, he's not as interested in her affections, while she, of course, thinks that he's like a big stage producer who's going to, you know, so she's fawning over him already because she's trying to, you know, get back onto Broadway, baby. Anyway, I don't know if this sounds interesting to either of you, but it's very funny. I would give it a big recommendation.
You know, a movie I recently watched like that was the original Birdcage, the like French farce.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like it would be kind of like that. Yeah.
But just the way you're talking about how it like goes just up to the line where it's like some of the laughs in this theater are not quite the right kind of laugh. And, you know, it would then nail like a pretty classically funny bit where at least everyone is like empathetic and on the side of the homosexual characters, and it's not like all punching down. I'm also imagining audiences watching this and then going to just kind of a random bathhouse called the Ritz and getting a much more like divey experience.
One thing that is very funny about it is, I mean, I guess I'm going to pretend like I'm speaking hypothetically or maybe not pretend. The rooms in the Ritz are very bathhousey rooms. Like it's plywood and Marilyn Monroe posters and, you know, like blacked out windows. But the lobby itself is very fancy and pretty and like, you know, very old Hollywood, which I thought was very funny.
There was once upon a time where you could have seen Bette Midler playing in bathhouses. I think that's like how they got really famous on that scene.
So, yeah, I mean, it has that air of truth. And it is interesting because it's about bathhouse culture, you know, to an extent. And it's set in and made in 1976. So like just a couple of years before everything in that culture went to shit as a result of the AIDS virus, as a result of HIV.
But post Stonewall, though, so.
Yes, it's like it's during that, you know, Weimar period
of the 70s. Yeah.
And another thing that was very funny that I wanted to mention about this one is that one of the people who comes to the bathhouse signs in under the name Ronald Reagan, like as a joke, so that they don't have to use their real name. Everybody pronounces it as Regan, which is very funny to me because like, it's like, of course, everybody would just read it on movie posters. He wasn't like the worst monster in American history of the last 100 years yet. Not yet the president, not yet, you know.
Particularly a villain to gay men as well.
Yes.
Not quite, you know, betraying Rock Hudson levels yet.
Yeah. When our straight Gaetano character shows up and he's like, Ronald Reagan, there's even a bit where the guy at the counter is like, yeah, don't you know, all the old ones are queens. He really had a thing with John Wayne. And so it's funny to think of like there being a time where like Reagan was not yet the boogeyman to all queer people everywhere and was still someone who could be a punchline instead. And then finally, I saw a movie called Gasoline Rainbow. You should see it, a review of it, rather, go up on SwampFlix.com very soon. I have finished writing it, Brandon. I'm just going to give it a proofread after this and send it over to you. But this is a movie that I managed to catch at a festival. It is directed by the Ross Brothers, which I believe, Brandon, they did Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which was a SwampFlix favorite.
Oh, yeah. Which had a local tie. I think they were like filming in New Orleans, but it was set in Vegas. But it was like a half documentary, half fiction setup where they had like a lot of locals at a dive bar mixing with actors.
Yeah, at the screening that I went to, the person who was doing the presentation mentioned that this was their first fully narrative film, but at the same time, it does have a lot of that documentary realism that is like a really important and integral part of what makes this one function. So this is a movie about five kids from Wiley, Oregon, which is like a based on the sign that we see at the beginning. It has less than 200 people there. I can't find any reference to it online, so I assume it's fictional.
I was going
to
say, I've never heard of it, but that doesn't mean it's not a real town.
They're 500 miles from the coast, is what we know. 513 or something.
Well, yeah, then I probably would have heard of it. It's not a real place.
So these five kids, they pile into a van, like a 90s van, and their goal is to have like one last adventure together before being adults sort of tears them apart now that they've finished high school and you know, are kind of left to their own devices, however briefly. So they pull all their money. They're just going to go to the coast, have one last adventure together before they have to grow up and get jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And it sounds like sort of a tired and cliched premise, but it's actually like very beautiful. It's beautifully shot. It has some of the weaknesses that you would expect from filmmakers who used to make documentaries and are making narrative features. You know, there is like sort of a tendency to cut to snapshots at certain points in a montage, or you know, there's voiceover over just like a sky with the moon in it, you know, that sort of thing that you usually comes as a result of like needing to have some footage that you've already shot to put like a voiceover over. And you know, it feels very much like something that had to be done in editing rather than what was intended, even though obviously it was intended because this is a purely narrative film. It just sort of feels like it's caught in the trappings of that. But that same like verisimilitude is like the movie's greatest strength as well. You know, it sort of has to forego the use of things like flashbacks in order to reveal character. It has to tell and not show. And the way that it manages to make that interesting is by doing it in this documentary style and having characters very organically reveal things about themselves to other people that they meet along the road. Because they set out in this van, but very quickly they have to like take part of the way on foot and then like train hop the rest of the way into Portland and then meet somebody with a boat who can take them to this party that they've been invited to, called the End of the World Party. And what's actually one of the really fun things about it is that by the time they get to the party, it's already been like raided by the cops. So they just have to keep going further down until they reach the coast anyway. It was very beautiful. It captures that like post party morning after fried lung feeling, that sort of like deep pink, you know, sunrise, you know, where you've partied too much and you wake up in a field. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, part of what could be a barrier for other people to enjoying this one is like how much you're able to tolerate like teenagers talking to each other about themselves. But because it feels very ad-libbed, like it feels like it was barely scripted, it's a lot more enjoyable than you would expect based on like that description. So I would give it a big recommendation if you're able to catch it in your screening area.
It looks like Mubi picked up the distribution for it. And in my experience, their theatrical windows are usually pretty small. And then their acquisitions usually play only on their platform with like no other way to watch it. So if you are interested and it does show up in your town, you probably have like a week window to catch it.
So catch it if you can. Oh, one thing I wanted to point out about Dick, just to circle back real quick, Brandon, is that it was written and directed by Andrew Fleming, and it was the very next project that he wrote and directed right after The Craft.
I swear to God, I thought you were going to say Pumpkin.
Not this time. But Brandon, what have you been watching?
Well, since y'all are bragging about going to fabulous film festivals and pubs lately.
Oh yeah, well I don't usually, so it's exciting.
Yeah, well I don't usually go to concerts, and I went to one the other night.
Ooh,
I saw Slater Kinney for the first time.
Oh sweet. Oh, nice.
Very cool.
Since The Woods, which was like what, like 07?
I was gonna 06? Say 06 or 07. Yeah,
and if you know that band, you know that they've since parted ways with their drummer and their quality of music has declined rapidly since then.
Yeah.
So I was a little nervous about paying money to go see them in concert again, since I had such a great time the first time I saw them. And I gotta say, I guess it's the only reason I'm bringing it up, but I gotta say, as someone who was doubting whether it was worth seeing them live, they may not be the like one of the greatest bands in the world anymore, but they're still a very good band. Yeah, I had a very fun time watching them play guitar. Corin's voice is still extremely powerful. When they want to do that dueling guitar post-punk thing where it sounds like they're playing two songs on top of each other, they can still do it very well. It's just the newer songs are more in that like Thin Lizzy, Kiss, like stadium rock kind of sound, which isn't usually my thing, but I don't know, watching it live was a whole different experience than listening to it on headphones.
Yeah, I haven't listened to any of their new stuff. Like, I guess the last thing they put out years and years ago I had listened to, it was,
They've had like four or five albums since The Woods, and I can't say any of them are like particularly memorable or good.
Yeah.
But I can say that they are still a very good band. I mean, I guess if you've been playing together for 30 years, if nothing else, just the routine of the two main people in that group now, touring constantly and all that time, that means something, you know, it builds.
Yeah.
And they have good chemistry still on stage. I also went to a single film fest screening in the past week. It's Patois Film Fest, was in New Orleans recently. It might be wrapped up by now. And it is a local political activism fest. Play a lot of documentaries, but it's a lot about like political agitation. And I usually try to make it out to at least one screening there every year. There's usually something interesting. And this time they played this movie called Rebel Dykes from 2021, which I've been wanting to see since it played in festivals 3 years ago, but it has no distributor. It's just been like a solo self-distributed documentary that's, I guess, continue to play small film festivals like this, and you know, you catch it when you can. It is a British documentary about this group of punks in 1980s London. It's a very loose movement. They're basically like a group of feminists who could have gone one or two ways. They could have gone the hippie route, which was their kind of like rivals in town. We're very into like political lesbianism, where it's like, you choose to be lesbian as a political act, and it's more about rejection of the patriarchy than it is about lust.
Yeah.
And these women instead went the other route, where it's like, we are lesbians because we want to fuck women. And they opened this S&M nightclub called Chain Reaction in London.
That's a good name.
And this is in the 80s, so this is around the time that like home video camcorders were starting to become affordable for like an average person. So there is a bunch of like grainy video art style footage of all these like strange S&M acts in this like dungeon with all these punks, you know, blocking out the sun with trash bags, dressing up in leather, and just like putting on a S&M cabaret for themselves. And it's pretty fabulous. Like, that footage is great. The more they get into playing with the camcorders, they decide to start making their own pornography. And start making these like, it starts off as zines, but ends up just being like fine art photography of all these different poses and like leather getups. And the more they brush up against the other faction of feminists in town, the more they have to like solidify their politics. And it becomes more than just about these sex parties. And especially when Thatcher starts enacting these like basically like anti-gay legislation, the two sides have to sort of like join forces and fight a bigger enemy. And they become like actually very politically active and like basically doing like weekly riots and protests for one gigantic fuck up from Thatcher's parliament after another. And yeah, it's a very like invigorating movie. It's very cheap. There's a lot of like animation, I would say, is like early 2000s Flash style, which is not particularly nice to look at, but kind of adds to the charm of this being like kind of a homemade production of people who were there at the time. And honestly, it's kind of a luxury to have so many people from an 80s queer scene alive and around to tell tale from like firsthand account. That's a pretty rare treat. So yeah, it was like a cheap movie that might have distribution issues because it has what a lot of people would consider a slur in the title. And honestly, credit card companies control a lot of the flow of commerce when it comes to that. Like, they won't allow certain profanity to be distributed in any like official capacity, which is basically how porn is regulated as well. But the movie is also kind of an ode to pornography and like somewhat of a participator in it as well. So that fits what it's doing. And also like, yeah, it's just got this like homemade DIY vibe that's like true to its punk ethos as well. And I found it very energizing. It was like one of those movies that could have been a bunch of people sitting around talking about the glory days and like the kind of you had to be there stories. But it also had this like very rich archive of vintage material. And it was also very energizing and like, you know, the queer anti-assimilationist politics of it are still very relevant now. But also the like, your government is stepping on your neck. What are you going to do about it? And, you know, it's like a political organizing motivator as well. Yeah, it's kind of weird to like recommend something. I don't know that you can go out and access immediately, but if Rebel Dykes comes to town, I think it's worth seeing if you're at all interested in the subject.
If there is one place that's screening all three of these hard to find movies that we've talked about so far, like we said, make a day of it.
Yeah, make a day of it. Go see all of them and report back to us, I guess, and tell us how your brain is.
Yeah, tell them Swampflix sent ya. And they'll be like, what?
Who?
Speaking of which, MUBI distributed this film that I've been wanting to see from Britain last year called How to Have Sex, which premiered at Cannes and is now, you know, coming out in America. And MUBI released it the week that Dune Part 2 came out. So it was barely here, but I went out to watch it because I find their movies hard to access without subscribing to their streaming service, which is another expense I can't just add onto the pile. How to Have Sex is a docufiction style thing, kind of like Gasoline Rainbow, the way you were describing it, where it's about these three girls going on vacation in Greece to one of those kind of like Girls Gone Wild spring break style resorts where you're in a foreign country, but really you're in this like Disney World artificial environment.
Oh, sort of like Infinity Pool.
Right. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it's like specifically designed for teens and 20 somethings to get drunk inside of it. Like it's like a Bourbon Street LSU binge drinking kind of environment. Lots of neon lights.
Oh no.
Sugary punch bowls full of tiki drinks and green alcohol and just people doing shots and puking and then going back and doing more shots, you know.
You've painted a hell of a picture.
It is hell. I mean, no doubt. It brought me back to LSU in not a great way.
Open parentheses derogatory, close parentheses.
Exactly. Or like every now and then you have that friend from out of town who wants to walk down Bourbon Street and you're like, why do we have to do that? But if that sounds like a hedonistic, like indulging in it, you know, kind of like that Spring Breakers movie that Harmony Korine made, it's not like that. It's this kind of docufiction style thing where it feels like real people. Like instead of seeing the fabulous night they're having in their heads when they're like screeching karaoke or eating cheese fries in the gutter, like you're actually watching the real facts of it. And it's like horrifying that these like teenage girls who are still in the British equivalent of high school are just like getting blackout drunk with the intent of losing their virginity while they're on vacation. And the movie very quickly becomes a story about sexual assault. I would say it would be easy for it to be a movie about like someone who's preying on kids who are blackout drunk and like, you know, physically overpowering them when they're, you know, not in a place to defend themselves. But it's actually more realistic than that. It's like all these kids show up at this place with the intention of getting very drunk and having sex with each other. So everyone is like in this like consensual atmosphere where they're trying to get each other in bed. And still within that, they're so poorly socialized and also selfishly abusive to each other, where it's like all about themselves and there's no like room for like intimate, genuine connection. It's more like, how do I get what I want? That instead of it being about a violent physical assault, it's about this man who like wears someone's will down, gets them isolated, basically like turns them down when they are consenting to sex and just like gradually manipulates them into a situation that's like selfishly pleasurable for him. And it's like so weird. It's so uncomfortably true to a lot of people's first sexual experiences in a way that's like, it's like an ice bath. It's like really cold and like it's under your skin. Recent movies it reminded me of, Pleasure was this movie about someone who just turned 21 and wanted to get into the porn business. So she like moves to LA and is gradually like her consent is eroded in the same way that this character's is. And it becomes this like expose about how the porn industry manipulates consent in order to exploit people and like uses the language of consent to get people to do stuff they're actually not comfortable with. And it also reminded me of The Royal Hotel, in which, you know, alcohol violently fans the flames of this like sexual violence atmosphere. I guess the difference is like both of those are very political movies to the point where they're almost allegorical. Whereas like How to Have Sex plays like a very real drama. Like these feel like real characters to you, and their situational drama is not entirely to prove a political point. It's like, this is just something that happens to people. And yeah, it's just tough to watch. It wasn't really like my kind of thing exactly. I kind of liked the feverish over the top version of it in The Royal Hotel, even though that has like a similarly chilling effect. This is more like real world hard facts version of like how consent is eroded by these like abusive young boys. Tough stuff.
Yeah, sounds like it.
But I don't know, if you have like a taste for that kind of like docufiction style, it's very well done. And it's this director's first movie. All the performances are really good. It's just like harrowing is the word I'm sure a lot of people use in their reviews. And I guess I'll lighten the mood a little bit. I watched a fun sex movie called Blood of the Virgins from 1967.
Sounds promising.
Yeah, I was going to say, love the title.
It's this Argentinian vampire movie.
Oh,
where
okay.
It kind of feels like a Hammer horror or like a Jesus Franco style, like smutty vampire movie. But instead of it being in like this old Gothic castle, it's like in a log cabin, I guess, because that's what was on hand. And the early part of it is all these like hippies traveling in this ski trip montage where, I mean, once you establish that vampires are real in this log cabin, you know, you kind of have to attract victims to them. So they just show these like hippies like go-go dancing in these dive bars, doing some downhill skiing, smoking weed and making out. And it's like this almost like Russ Meyer style montage. It's like pure smut film, but in kind of like a kitschy nudie cutie way. It's like very quick cuts. It's basically just about boobs bouncing. Like there's nothing like really too salacious about it. And then they get to the vampire's log cabin and they're preyed upon one by one. I will say the vampire's more of a titty sucker than a neck biter. Like it's that kind of movie. You can tell from the runtime, it's like 73 minutes, that this was like designed to be kind of background noise at like a drive-in so people can make out. And it's supposed to be like half of a double feature, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of those movies, the coherence of it really falls apart in the back half. Like it has a lot of fun swinging 60s energy out front. And then once it kind of has your money and is like delivered enough gore and nudity, then it's kind of done its job and just like ceases to have a purpose for the last 40 minutes.
I'm familiar with these kind of pictures.
Yeah, I think we've all seen them. Yeah.
Yeah. I like this kind of, you know, outdated smut. I think it's very fun and kind of harmless in a way. And I've seen a lot of cheap vampire movies in my time. This one did something I've never seen before, where instead of like doing rubber bats or the vampire transformations, they show kind of like vacation looking footage of seagulls flying with a red filter over it and bat noises on the soundtrack.
Incredible.
I don't know if they were trying to trick me into thinking that those seagulls were bats or if the idea was the vampires turn into seagulls instead.
Well, if they're beach vampires, that makes sense.
They're ski cabin vampires.
Oh, that's right.
You know, I think trying to make sense of it is the path of madness, maybe.
It is, yeah.
It's one of those things where, like, the more you kind of pick at it, you're like, I've put more thought into this than the filmmakers did.
Yeah, they're like, just get some birds in there. We'll put sounds over it. Nobody will tell.
And I guess the other reason to bring it up is that I saw all this gore and nudity on a streaming service called Tubi. Despite reports otherwise that we cannot access such things on Tubi. But I might be stepping on our main topic by mentioning this, so maybe it's time to move on.
Blind date is coming. No wonder you're nervous. Relax. He knows how to treat a lady. And no one ever complains. Blind date. You won't be coming home in one piece. Rated R from New Line Cinema.
All right. Well, speaking of Tubi and titties, our podcast this week, we watched 1984's Blind Date, also known as Deadly Seduction, an independent erotic thriller from German film. I'm sorry, not German. It would make more sense if it were from Greek filmmaker Niko Mastorakis.
But if it were German, we wouldn't get a certain actress that I love, but we'll get to her.
You're way ahead of me, but we're on the same wavelength. Brandon, do you know what's coming?
The bell will be rung imminently. Yes.
Well, not imminently. It'll be soon.
So I became aware of this one because of a Walter Chow tweet from October of last year, where he was saying that this movie marries an Argento premise, and then he says, or De Palma from the same era, same. But with a cyborg thing that predicts both the Elon Musk brain chip and disclosure. And I was so intrigued by this description. He says, lots of dedicatedly sleazy exploitation and occasional etch-a-sketch computer POV. Boy, did I not know what that was going to mean.
And it makes you wait a long time to get to that, too.
It sure does.
45 minutes into the film.
Yeah, that's like my biggest complaint is, and then even that scene itself is so long.
So I will say, whenever I saw this tweet, I was like, oh, let me Google this movie. And when I looked up the description of it, it struck me as reminding me a lot of Monkey Shines in its premise.
Yes!
Where I was like, oh, this could be really fun. And it is very unlike Monkey Shines, and that in Monkey Shines, he's got that monkey within 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't take that long for him to get that monkey or for us to understand the monkey. This movie takes a really, really long time to get anywhere. And it is very Argento-esque and that it's kind of nonsensical.
Yeah, the science is really bad, and I kind of love it.
But to give a thorough plot description for our listeners, this guy who's like an ad executive, he ends up in Greece, and in his voiceover that introduces him, we learn that it's because he spent some time in the Middle East, and he does not want to go back to the States immediately because he wants to have like a halfway point between the modern West and being able to think about 500 years ago. He sees this woman who is participating in a photo shoot that his company is doing and becomes obsessed with her and thinks that she is his former lover that he hasn't seen in a really long time, who he hasn't spoken to after he failed to prevent her from being assaulted by four men. So in following her around, he ends up like following her on a date, being chased away, and then I guess falling down a cliff and losing his eyesight.
He like hits a branch.
Yeah, he just like walks into a tree branch.
Yeah.
It does not look like a traumatic experience, really.
I don't know.
He just kind of bumps into something.
It kind of looks like you could get a bad concussion from it, but like the blindness was wild.
Well, the doctors explain it to him. There's nothing wrong with your eyes.
There's nothing wrong with his eyes.
There's nothing wrong with him.
I'm going to be
brain injury.
100% honest with you. I understood why Madame Web was blind at the end of Madame Web. if it was doing better in explaining its premise than this movie, then I don't think it's our fault for not really understanding why he was blinded, especially because the doctors are puzzled as well. Which, to me, when this happens, I'm still in that sort of like monkey shines mode where I'm like, oh, okay, maybe he'll eventually regain his sight and that's what this is about.
Yeah, I was wondering that too.
But instead he volunteers to never see again.
Yes. Dr. Dave from 2001 is like, yeah, if we do this procedure, there's a 100% chance that you'll never see normally again. Whereas right now, it seems like you've got psychosomatic blindness that could go away at any time.
I mean, he didn't say psychosomatic. He just said trauma-based, which could mean a traumatic brain injury.
I mean, from the perspective of the audience, the doctor says there's no physical trauma. Well, trauma, right? Which, yeah, to me makes me seem, it's like, okay, so it's all in his mind.
To be fair, he does love his Sony Walkman more than he loves the ability to see out of his eyeballs. Like, the first time we see him, he is walking down the street with his Sony Walkman headphones on, just enjoying being in his little hermetic world, in his little Reaganite fucking outfits.
That made me wonder if we were going to have like a little bit of a tightrope thing, because the killer also had a Sony Walkman that he was listening to, but his was red, and it's like, oh, parallels. But like this movie, okay, so he's blinded. He accepts the possibility. He goes to this doctor. It's Keir D'Elia. The doctor is like, yes, I can give you this experimental surgery that will, and we're going to put like electrodes in your brain where you're going to have sonar from your Walkman that will then connect to the plates that we're putting in surgically and give you like Etch-a-Sketch Daredevil vision.
Yeah.
What were those like Game Boy camera things that kind of had that
Game Boy,
right?
Camera, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. It kind of looks like a film negative, but you only see the outlines of stuff.
I talk about the Game Boy camera like every other month and how
I
miss
it. It's a beautiful aesthetic, to be honest.
So from this premise, he still continues to stalk this blonde woman and then becomes aware of a serial killer who is on the loose cutting up these women. And interestingly, it's not very violent. You actually don't see very much. It's unlike a giallo in that, like, I don't think there's blood in this movie anywhere.
There is. There is. There's one scene where the killer slashes the throat of a guy.
Oh, right, right. I guess there's a little bit of blood, but it's really not what you would expect from this premise, right, and how giallo it is. Like,
well, they don't want to get in the way of turning you on either, because it's definitely more about seeing boobs than it is about, like, scaring you.
I guess that's true.
They think higher of the audience than to think they might be turned on by women being killed, luckily.
The love interest in this movie, I guess, is Kirstie Alley. He doesn't, yes, seem to value her very much at all. She is, like, his secretary that he sleeps with, although she is not above arranging for, like, all of their friends and colleagues to, like, interrupt them mid-coitus for a surprise birthday party?
That is the worst thing. I'd be so upset.
I don't think that I would enjoy having her as my partner either, but she stands by him through all of this, even while he continues to, like, stalk and obsess about this one blonde woman. There's something so bizarre.
It kind of feels like she's the same way about him as he is about this blonde woman a little bit. Except she has better access. Like, they both seem like they don't know how to have a relationship with people.
They're kind of evenly matched, but yeah, they're also like yuppie scum.
Yes.
Like, they're kind of like powerful business bitches. They're like one-upping each other, mm-hmm, in this like work relationship that is not, you know, ethical. But it's a lot more charming on her. Like, he's the kind of guy that wears novelty t-shirts with a blazer over it.
I heart my dentist.
Oh my God.
I heart my dentist. Yeah, what?
Meanwhile, she has, like, the power business bitch wardrobe down with that very loose, open silk blouse with no bra.
Oh, my God. So good. I was like, I would wear that.
It also seems like she is perfectly capable of filling in for him the whole time that he just does nothing. There's no indication that any of the accounts are slacking while he's wandering around breaking into this woman's penthouse.
No, she's got it. She's on top of it.
She's got it all under control.
I mean, Don Draper used to disappear for weeks and, you know, his work still got done too.
Yeah, she is the Peggy of this movie, I guess. There is a very bizarre scene at the end where she, like, is trying to meet up with him or follow him to a place in a taxi, and she just is like, ugh, never mind, I'm gonna run the rest of the way. And she runs a really long time.
I thought she got out of the car because she thought that was the killer, maybe.
That's totally a possibility, but I could not tell.
Yeah.
It's confused, and, like, actually the whole movie doesn't really have an ending. Like, you kind of expect that because there are so few characters that matter in this movie, that, like, there's this big twist coming where either the Sony Walkman guy is the killer and just doesn't know it because he's, like, spying on women to the point where he's, like, doing break and enteries and, like, touching people while they sleep. Like, he's a real sleazeball.
This is a real weird protagonist.
Or you expect, because she's the other, like, character with lines and, like, an eternal life, that Kirstie Alley is going to be, like, in this shocking twist at the end. She's the killer.
I was thinking that's where it was going to be, but...
I thought it was going to be Keir D'Elia because of the surgical stuff.
But yeah, okay, the surgery really just feels like disconnected to anything else in the movie, as is the reveal of who's the killer. Like, yeah.
I guess, I mean, we know, we should spoil this. I don't think that we should worry about this even a little bit.
There's no twist.
Yeah,
don't worry about
it. The killer is the Stalky's boyfriend. And early on, it is established that he is a surgeon, although he's not actually. And we don't ever get, like, a scene
what
where,
he actually does.
Yeah, even like Argento, like, even like a movie like, goodness, what's the one with the blind guy, the type it's a real early one, Cat of Nine Tails. Like, even in Cat of Nine Tails, you're gonna have a scene where a character, like, finds out some fact, like, oh, her boyfriend's not actually a surgeon, that explains, or that they would reveal that after the fact. And it's like there is a scene of that in this movie theoretically, but it got cut. And it's like, there's so much missing that makes the whole thing seem kind of, like, incomprehensible. It's very difficult to pay attention to.
It is.
Well, I mean, kind of like I was saying about Blood of the Virgins, like, it's kind of delivering what you're supposed to get early on. Like, him spying on women undressing with his binoculars is what the movie wants to deliver to you. And then the sort of, like, novelty tech of the time, the Walkman being, like, exploited, or, like, him playing Pong on his, I guess, Atari.
On 6 television monitors.
Oh, my gosh. It wasn't Pong. It was Breakout.
Okay.
Sorry. I just feel the need to correct you on that one.
Allie just saved us from so much flame commenting, though. That's
I
important.
Did.
And there's the scene where he, like, plugs the video game directly into his brain and it, like, over...
Oh, that was great.
...powers his electric pulses up
I was
there.
Like, this is the most dude moment. You know what?
But
I'm
like, that is the movie delivering what it's supposed to deliver. It's like the 80s novelty tech and the, you know, titties with the voyeuristic remove. And then after that, it's kind of just done its job. Mm-hmm. And like towards the end, it's just like, okay, now we have to have a bigger confrontation with the killer so we can like wrap it up and roll the credits. It's not in a particular rush to get there, but like it doesn't feel like it has to entertain you as it goes through the motions either.
Would that also explain why our character is someone it's like impossible to like? Like, from top to bottom, he's smug, he's smarmy, he's a shitty employer and boyfriend, which if you're ever both of those things, you are default shitty at one of them.
I mean, I think even though this is Greece, like, this is Reagan's quote-unquote America, and I think you are supposed to, like, see yourself as this guy, which is nuts. Because he's very unlikable.
I guess it did kind of remind me some of, like, Body Double.
Yeah, for sure.
You're like, yeah, obviously.
Like, well, yeah, I mean, I know you mentioned Argento a few times, and you did say De Palma earlier, but, like, those two guys got a lot of flack, I think, for, like, updating Hitchcock for the 70s and 80s, and I guess the biggest complaints they got were, like, you're sensationalizing what used to be, like, a classier version of thriller. You're bringing a lot of, like, modern aesthetics to something old, but you're not really adding anything new to it except this, like, misogynist leering and this misogynist violence that was not allowed when Hitchcock was making movies until he made something like Frenzy, which really goes hard into that.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Oh, God. He wasn't allowed to do it, so he just did it behind the scenes.
Right. I'm sure he would have if he was given free rein. But in this case, I think it's true that it recalls both of those directors, but for me, this is like pure De Palma knockoff.
Yeah, all the sleaze.
Especially body double with the, you know, he's the stalker, but someone else is also stalking someone. He's like, well, I'm the good stalker. I'm like keeping an eye on her.
Yes.
And then also, there's a lot of blowout in here as well, where he's like pulling back.
Right. I was thinking about that movie. Yeah.
And there's also a little bit of Dress to Kill, to the point where I was expecting Kirstie Alley to be like secretly a trans woman that's killing everybody.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, that explains why y'all weren't thinking it would be Kirstie Alley. Okay, amazing.
And then she busts in a room towards the end and says, like, it's your girlfriend, the world's foremost female impersonator.
Oh my god, that's true. She does say that, which is a very bizarre, huh?
I saw this movie at Overlook last year called We Kill for Love, and it's this 3-hour documentary about the history of the erotic thriller. And one of its like thesis points was that like the main nexus of that entire genre is Dress to Kill. And like everything was built off of that movie's back.
That is fascinating.
And I mean, this movie kind of proves it a little bit. Like, there's so much De Palma in here to the point where it feels like almost like if De Palma made a sarcastic version of like what everybody said was his worst qualities. You know, like all you want to do is look at boobs through binoculars and kill women. And like your plots don't mean anything. These aren't real characters. You're just ripping off Hitchcock and dressing it up with some like 80s novelty aesthetics, like for the music video era. And he did get all those complaints. And this movie is kind of like proof that it's like proof of two things. One, that like De Palma did have his own style and flair that like wasn't just a Hitchcock knockoff for the 80s.
Right. Like, it's identifiable.
And it's a quality difference. Like his movies are good. This movie is a mess. But the other thing it proves is that even with the like kind of auteurist control and like clear artistic vision that he had removed from the situation, that exercise of like updating Hitchcock for this era is still fun on its face. Like,
yeah,
this movie is a complete mess. It has no direction. It has no clear goals.
The plot is questionable. Like, just sense-wise, like, we don't even understand the basic conceit.
But you know what? When it cuts away to, like, a montage of swimsuit models in a 1980s mall being voyeuristically stared at by men with cameras, I'm like, this is cinema, and I love it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's something inherently fun about the exercise, even without someone who actually knows what they're doing behind the camera.
Yeah. I will say, you know, as far as like legitimate criticisms, we're all in agreement that the like gimmick, the sci-fi gimmick of this movie, which is that he gets like an electric eyeball, sort of, that he gets like Etch-a-Sketch Daredevil vision, comes almost at the halfway point. This is a 100-minute movie. You were saying that this was like the movie that you were talking about, Brandon, Vampires in the Chateau.
Blood of the Virgins. Which, if you search for it on Tubi, you have to search for it by its Argentinian title. It's like Sangre de Virgenes.
Amazing.
You can't actually search for it by its English title, which is pretty great.
Like, you were talking about how that one serves its purpose, but that one's 70 minutes, and this one is like
1 hour 40 minutes. I was like, what?
Yeah, it's 100 minutes long, and he does not get his, like, you know, weird vision thing until 40 minutes in. And everything that we have before that time frame to establish his character makes us hate him.
It makes us hate him, and we get, like, first-person point of view from the killer.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what we get. It's slashing through boobs and this horrible guy.
Like, say what you will about Monkey Shines, which is over 2 hours long, but he has that accident where he gets hit by the truck within the first 4 minutes. It does not waste its time.
I kind of like how formless that is, though, because like in that early stretch before the implant, he's seeing visions of the killer's movements already through the killer's eyes.
I didn't think that was him seeing it. I thought we were just seeing it as the audience.
That was my question, was like, is he psychically linked to this guy?
I wish.
That's what it seemed like. Why else would we be in the killer's like place?
Well, because that's what Argento did.
Okay. Without any thought put into why.
Yeah, you know? There's no thought put into why at all, but it's just because that's how Dario did it. So that's how we're going to do it here.
But I think the thing is, like, my mind goes there because I'm presented with these images without context or meaning behind them, and your brain is looking for patterns.
Okay.
I kind of like invent reasons for what
actually,
it's doing.
Actually, I can answer it. I actually can answer this narratively for the movie. Is we are seeing a lot of these, so we're establishing, okay, this movie has a murderer. And then we know that he has already paid attention and noticed that there is a murderer because he was stalking old girl and heard the murderer's car and saw him at the window. So, like, us seeing that scene, we are establishing the fact that he was already there when he noticed the sound of the car back when he was, like, trying to access his memories.
Even though when the killer chases him off and he gets blinded by barely getting hit in the face with a branch.
Yeah.
He could have heard the car at that time.
Yes.
Okay, but, like, this kind of filmmaking has its own concrete language and its reasons for doing stuff. So, like, there are so many movies about people who have, like, brushes with the afterlife or losses of sense, and it, like, heightens other senses, and they become psychically linked to murderers and help the police solve crimes by this, like, phenomenon they can't explain, but they, like, go to sleep at night and have sweaty dreams where they, like, see through the eyes of the killer. And this movie is using that visual language, but without the plot reason for it.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, it was just establishing the fact that he had witnessed this guy before, I think, because is what was going on.
Normally, your protagonist would somehow be involved with the investigation.
Yeah.
Or they would have seen one of the killings, like, in
at the
Crystal
very
Plumage.
Beginning.
And therefore, that tells both the character and the audience that there's a killer.
Yeah.
This character does not know that there is a killer because he is so self-absorbed. And yeah. All he cares about is just leering at women. Those scenes where we see things through the killer's point of view are there to let us and the audience know there's a killer, so we'll know that eventually the movie gets to it. I'm not saying that that's good filmmaking.
It's not
but
good,
I do think
but,
that's what's
yeah.
happening here.
That's what's happening. It's not good, and it's not, like, it doesn't follow the rules of the visual language, but I'm just saying, like, no, he's not psychically linked.
I think its sloppiness kind of makes it fascinating. Like, the fact that it is formless, like, you are leaning in trying to make sense of it, and you're looking for reasons for things that are kind of just sloppily, like, slapped on the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, even the ending, if you want to talk about police investigations, like, what happens at the end?
Yeah, what happens at the end?
He kills the killer.
Yes.
Right? He finds the guy and kills him, and he's like, Rachel, this woman I've been stalking, you call the cops. You are free. I have freed you of this, like, burden.
Yeah.
But what's really funny is, like, from her perspective, all that's happened is she went on, like, a night swim with her date and somebody
murdered
the guy.
Murdered him. Yeah.
Makes no sense.
Yeah. She just has to take this guy's word for it that, like, her boyfriend is a murderer. Like, yeah. Absolutely.
Her dead
wild.
Boyfriend.
Yeah.
I want to take this poll. Does he know this woman? Is this the woman from his past?
I don't think he knows this woman.
Unclear to me.
Yeah.
I do not believe
it's sufficient evidence.
I don't think it's her either.
That makes it a more interesting movie.
It does. I was going to say, to me, that was what made the movie interesting is, like, because he, like, asked that person, like, hey, is there any record of old girl? And we didn't hear the phone call where he said that, but, like, he gets a call that was like, there's no record of Marianne or, like, Rachel, whatever, in the embassy.
Yeah, there's no record of her as either name.
Yeah.
Hey, it could be her. It could not be her. I don't know. Like, I honestly, like, found myself trying to make sense of the story too much. I guess by the end, I did buy it at face value. Like, in his mind, at least, he's the hero of the day.
Yes.
So I guess I kind of bought that. Like, he found this woman, finally protected her, and, like, kind of rides off on the sunset cowboy style with his new girlfriend.
There's so many ways that I could like him better if he weren't so gross. In the sense that, like, you know, what if the woman that he remembers died? Because,
yeah,
like, what his in
that's
his,
what I was thinking.
In his memory, the doctor is like, no, you can't see
you
her
can't
right
see
now.
Her, not yet.
And it does sort of have this, you know, ambiguousness to it where, like, okay, she just can't stand to see him because of what happened to her, and maybe she never will. Or also, like, maybe she's dead.
Yeah, and they're just, like, lying to her. You're, like, lying to him. Like,
yes.
You can't see her now. Or
And the thing
not
is,
for many, many years.
the pointlessly traumatized protagonist is another giallo convention. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's like he has this traumatic backstory, not for any plot reason, because, I mean, if it made it clear whether or not she was Marion, like, even if it made it clear she wasn't, and that he was having this sort of, like, you know, Don Quixote vision to save the woman that he couldn't before, that would have given his actions more meaning to me, and I would be a little bit more forgiving of the fact that he broke into her house and caressed her face while
and
she was
watched
sleeping.
Her sleep? Yeah.
What in the actual fuck?
I saw that and I was like, oh no.
Even the guy in body double is only a peeping Tom.
He follows her around and like takes her underwear out of the trash. I don't know. He crosses some lines in that.
I don't know. Touching someone while they're sleeping is like,
yeah, that's pretty
that's
intimate.
A whole other level. I cannot deal with.
I mean, if this is a movie about somebody who thinks he's white knighting somebody and in fact is like becoming a stalker and a terror to her because of that.
Yeah.
Then that's an interesting angle on this kind of story. And I feel like De Palma could have made a movie like that. That would have been very good. But like in this version, what would have to happen for that to be real is at the end, a clear signal to the audience that this is not the woman he thinks she is. And also a clear signal that this surgeon killer that he's been protecting her from was also not a real threat. Like that he was like misinterpreting stuff like Rear
yes.
Window style.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we're not allowed to think that. It does the good work of being clear about that by having us see the point of view of the killer at some point, I guess.
Yeah, and having the scalpel in the underwear. Like, he could just be, like, taking out his scalpel and, like, putting it with the rest of his clothes instead of, like, actually, like, taking it out and, like, stuffing it in his, like, swim trunks, you know? Like,
yeah,
it could have been ambiguous still.
It's poorly constructed, like, in every way, in the sense that, like, I don't think that we have any reason for there's no reason that our protagonist should believe that this night is the night that the killer is going to kill this woman and that there's some sort of time limit on it suddenly since he's just been killing random women. Like, if there's a reason why he thinks it's that night, we're never given it.
It's like there's a bunch of genre pieces for like familiar story templates that are all here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not actually used in a recognizable way.
Yeah, it's like, but we want them to be.
I've seen this piece in movies before. I've seen this surgeon killer. I've seen this like supernatural version of sight. You know, I've seen all these different genre pieces before. I'm just gonna do all of them at once without coming up with like a coherent order for like how they're going to be put together.
It's like when you get a bad remix.
That movie, I really like it. Let's put it in the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know what? Like, that's fun to watch if you've seen 100 movies like this. And recently we've been on a kind of a streak between like Tightrope and Silent Partner in this. Like, we've seen it done well and coherently, but it's kind of fun to see like a sloppy, deconstructed version of it.
Yeah.
You kind of choose your own adventure for what the fuck it's trying to do.
I think the first like shot where I finally just like gave in to the fact that like, obviously I was making fun of the science because I thought it was hilarious. And like, you know, I never expect science to be good in movies, but I always have to make fun of it anyway. But so the first one where I was just like, okay, this movie is not really making that much sense, is there is this scene where he is walking down the street and it like doesn't serve like really that much narrative purpose. I think it might be like right before he confronts the killer and he is just like backlit, like standing tall. And there's just like, it is just like, this was just done because you thought it looked cool and you're not wrong. You know, where he's like walking into the streetlight and it's just like his silhouette getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was like, yeah, you just thought those look cool and you're not wrong.
But in a story where he is like unknowingly the actual villain of a movie, like that would be a cool shot.
Yeah, exactly. It would be a cool narrative choice, but instead it's just kind of like, oh, let's do this.
I'm picturing those sort of early YouTube days where people would recut movies into trailers in different genres. Like, Shining is like a rom-com. and Mary Poppins as like a horror.
Mrs. Doubtfire was a pretty funny one.
Yes.
Yeah, that one was, yeah.
And I'm imagining them doing that with this movie, but honestly, you don't have to change that much. Like, there's almost nothing that you would change in order to make this a movie about, like, a man who doesn't let being blind stop him from stalking.
I do want to mention my favorite thing about, like, how sloppily this movie's put together with, like, how much thought, though, is, like, the sequence of him getting surgery that's supposed to, you know, fix his blindness.
Oh, yeah.
In a roundabout way. He agrees to the surgery, even though he's told that he could possibly see again without it. And then they do the surgery and hook him up to the Walkman. And then after that, start explaining how it works and the limitations of it and what he can and can't do. The sequence of that is absolutely baffling to me. Like, wouldn't you want everything explained to him before it's done?
He really jumps the gun. That's something that he just does, as we saw over the course of the movie.
I kind of appreciated that exposition, though.
Oh, I appreciated it, too. It just would make way more sense before the surgery than it does after.
Oh, yes. It would, but
narratively,
it's fun to have it.
Yeah, narratively, you want them to be showing him how the vision thing is going to work while they explain it to him.
Yeah.
Right.
As, like, a filmic language thing. But you're not wrong that, like, it doesn't make any sense that they didn't, like, do some prep work first.
But, yes, you're also not wrong that that is just his character. He's just like, I'm not going to listen to anyone. Let's do it. Because he is that bro.
Yuppie scum, man.
Like, once again, hooking in his video game to a thing that his doctor has already explained could cause seizures, like, that is just who he is as a guy.
After the surgery, they tell him, you know, give it like a 2-hour adjustment period. And then from there on, I don't know, never use it for more than 15 minutes at a time. He is never without it. There is never a moment that it's off for the entire rest of the movie.
Yeah.
You said Monkey Shines a bunch earlier. It was reminding me of Lawnmower Man a little bit because we watched that for the show recently. And that's a very similar thing. It's like, directly plugging video games into your brain and like them overriding your brain waves. I mean, that's the good stuff though, right? Like them filming the video monitors while he's playing video games, or the night vision Game Boy camera, you know, view of the world.
Yeah, I agree.
Like that's what makes this movie
it
special.
Is, yes.
There are other moments that are fun. Like when he's spying on his woman he's trying to save, quote unquote, with his binoculars. There's this like theme song to the movie starts playing about how he always kisses on the first date.
It's
like cheesy like 80s pop tune. Like that's fun and like dated, but you can find dozens of movies about someone peeping with binoculars and there's a serial killer afoot. Most of them were directed by Dario Argento and Brian De Palma,
right?
the good ones were, but the video game stuff and like the Walkman vision is really what makes this like a special novelty. It would have been more fun if it came quicker in the story and, you know, it leaned a little heavier on that than it did on like the Hitchcock plot, but I thought it was pretty special when it was doing that stuff.
Yeah. Like I said, while watching it, you know, the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a Walkman is a good guy with a Walkman.
I want to go ahead and point out that whenever I did read the Wikipedia entry for this movie, there was one other thing that made me really interested in it, which is, of course, that it starred one of our favorites from Star Trek.
Yes.
That's right, Kirstie Alley.
Kirstie Alley, I was about to say.
Wrath of Khan.
But also Marina Sirtis, my dear beloved.
I think you and I might be the only people on Earth who have ever met each other who are like, yeah, Troy is my favorite character.
Troy, she's the best.
I was very disappointed about what happened to her in this movie.
Me too.
Brandon, if you don't recall her, she plays the character who has identified in the credits as, quote, hooker. She never has a single line other than a scream. Like, the whole thing is this, like, bad romantic music playing over, you know, the killer stalking her, bringing her back to her place in his taxi, her being like, yeah, I'll hook up with you. And then he ties her up. And then again, he draws marks on her body.
It's so funny because she's like, all right, this isn't weirder than I've seen before. And then he brings out the scalpel.
Yeah, she seems like, yeah, this is.
the most sex worker thing. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to pay extra for this, but, you know, it's not out of the question. And then, like, he pulls out the scalpel and she's like, oh, you can actually read her lips. And she says, oh, my God, what is that? Yeah. Or something to that effect. Or, oh, my God, what's happening? And yeah. I was so mad because, you know, when they talk about this movie, they, of course, mention Marina Sirtis and all of the online stuff because, you know, she is
famous. You get to see Marina Sirtis's boobs.
You do get to see her breasts, but she's famous to us as Counselor Troy. And I do remember that many years ago, I saw this video of her at a convention talking about, like, you know, the outfits that they put her in on TNG were very restrictive. They mm-hmm. were, you know, they were titillating and not always very flattering. And, you know, it was a pain for her to, like, stay in the exact shape that they wanted her to for these particular outfits. But she even mentioned in that con, she's like, but you don't understand how grateful I was to be on this show, because then I didn't have to keep making these, like, horrible, gross sex murder movies. And I'm like, oh, this is one of the ones that she was talking about. Like, this is the kind of yeah. movie she was glad she didn't have to do anymore. And bless her that she was able to get out of it.
I was thinking that the whole time I saw it. I was like, oh man, she was just like this regular, like, B, like, Greek actress, like, who lucked out, got a job on Star Trek. Like, what a gig.
Yeah, because she was also in Death Wish 3, and I'm pretty sure she's assaulted in that one, too.
Who isn't assaulted in the Death Wish movies?
Yeah. Cursed franchise.
But it is for just real. Sort of like, you know, thing. She was like, thank God, you know, and good for her.
I do want to talk about Tubi for a minute while we're on the subject of people watching movies specifically for boobs, which is that we did have a crisis this week where there was a lot of tweeting going around freaking out about distributors submitting censored versions of their films to Tubi. Some of the speculation said that it was on request, but that was extrapolated into Tubi is removing all nudity and gore from their platform.
Right. I sent a little bit of a Chicken Little text to the group chat, but I didn't think that it was, I did assume that it was a possibility, not that it was happening in real time or that it was being
forced. It wasn't just you. I mean, it was like the whole internet was freaking out. It was hard to get any, like, concrete information from it. One thing that did come up through that, though, like, I think it was a solid reminder that, like, I believe the Murdochs own Tubi. And as much as we like using that platform, I mean, every thing that's good in this world is owned by some evil corporation somewhere, you know?
Yes.
So it wouldn't be out of the question that, like, this company that just did a rebrand has this hideous logo now, and is one of the only actually profitable streaming platforms because of their ad-based structure, would try to clean up their act a little bit and try to sell to a bidder. Like, I was talking a little bit earlier about how, like, a movie like Rebel Dykes might have had a hard time getting distribution because of its, like, sort of racier material. Even Drive Away Dolls, which Boomer mentioned, was scripted to be called Drive Away Dykes, but is being tampered and made a little more accessible in its marketing with that retitle. And it wouldn't be out of the question that they'd be, like, asking for, like, TV edit versions of their movies. And honestly, we don't have access to those boardrooms. We don't know what those conversations are. Maybe they are doing that. But we can confirm that right now, the dream is still alive. Like, you can go on Tubi and watch the dumbest smut you've ever seen in your life, which includes both this movie and Blood of the Virgins.
So, live it up while you got it.
Yeah.
Oh, Tubi, we'll miss you when you're gone.
This is a quintessential Tubi movie.
It really is.
This is something you don't put a lot of hope and dreams into, and then, like, it delivers something very strange about halfway through.
Yes. Like, I did appreciate the weird, like, black and white sonar vision. Like I said, I will laugh at the science to the moon and back, but it's also great. It's also part of the charm.